You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 76 is Phil Manzanera. He was the guitarist for Roxy Music throughout their 1972 through 1983 tenure. He was credited as co-writer for over a dozen songs, including the one you are listening to right now, Over You, from 1980's Flesh and Blood. He's released at least 10 solo albums starting in 1975 and had many collaborations, like his 70s band 801 with other members of Roxy Music, his two albums with John Wetton, his recent Spanish language work with Lucho Brieva. He's also produced many albums, including the latest by David Gilmour, and he's toured with David Gilmour as the second guitarist. The songs we're going to talk about today include No Church in the Wild from his 2015 album The Sound of Blue that features singer Sonia Bernardo, who is in Phil's current live band, which is a cover of a song by Jay-Z and Kanye West featuring Frank Ocean that originated with a sample of Phil's playing from his 1978 album K-Scope. We're then going to turn back to 2004's Wish You Well from the album 6 O'Clock PM, a song that Phil sings. And finally, all the way back to the instrumental Diamond Head from the 1975 album of that name. And we'll conclude by listening to the track Magdalena, the version off his 2017 Live in Japan album. For more information, see manzanera.com. For more information about this podcast, visit nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And if you enjoy this interview, consider supporting our efforts at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. Let's get started. I will have played a little bit of Over You from Flesh and Blood just to remind folks of, was that the biggest hit that your songwriting was associated with?
Well, in a sense that it was a single, I guess it was. There was one other single called Trash, which was really trash and it didn't work. It's mainly album tracks like Out of the Blue or Amazona that I think people might know more, but I don't know.
Well, and then some of just your signature riffs. I mean, it wouldn't, the opening track on Avalon, your riff, that's the thing by which people recognize the song. I know you're often accused of, you do these guitar god tours and, you know, innovative guitarists, but yet you're, in other interviews, you've described your guitar sound as, well, I'm trying to sound like a keyboard. I'm trying to sound like, it doesn't jump out. It's not Clapton-esque and, you know, really obvious in your face, even when it's actually takes a very prominent part in many of those songs. It's not an obviously guitar-y sound.
Absolutely. Over the whole span of maybe the 45 years, there was a period when I got fed up with people saying, it's great, but there's no guitar on it. And me saying, but that is a guitar. And so then I started trying to, you know, play more Clapton-esque type, you know, obvious lead solo bits. I'm a collaborative sort of guitarist as well. I like to be part of the texture of a song, you know, I think.
Well, we're going to move very quickly to, so No Church in the Wild. In fact, before we even play that, I want to play just a little bit of K-Scope, which was the original thing that was sampled that became this song by Frank Ocean and Jay-Z and Kanye West, which then you covered in the version that we're going to hear in full, changing it quite a bit. So here's a little bit of K-Scope. I see there's a video of you online sort of telling the whole story of how this went out in the world, was sampled by somebody and came back to you. Do you want to tell the short version of that? Then we'll play the song in full and then we'll get into the details.
Basically, it's a little riff that I, you know, you come up with these things when you're watching the television the night before you're going in to record the next day and you need to do an instrumental. And I just played that little riff. You know, I thought, oh, that's good. I'll do that in the studio. Recorded it, I don't know, 1976, I think. And then 40 years later, it came back out of nowhere and ended up on a Jay-Z and Kanye West record.
The version we're in here is from The Sound of Blue, 2015, with you and the Sound of Blue band featuring Sonia Bernardo singing. The verses were written by Frank Ocean, is that right? The lyrics, but then the rap part that you got rid of for your version.
Yeah, what I decided to do was to take the, you know, my guitar riff and take aspects of the Jay-Z and Kanye West version, mainly the Frank Ocean bits, and have a girl sing it and change the structure and add a little chant thing in the middle. And I just thought, well, it's pointless doing a version of their version because we don't rap and it's nothing to do with. But I thought it'd be quite funny to do our own version. It's something that we play live and people seem to like it.
So from what I understand, this is basically a live band arrangement, right?
These musicians were sort of hovering around my studio, and I decided to go and do a gig a couple of years ago in between doing a big festival with and then going on tour with David Gilmour. I decided to do one gig. I put this band together, and I really liked the way it was sounding. And so we decided to just get them to play on that. And I was finishing an album called Sound of Blue, and I thought, right, well, I'll stick it, which is mainly, it's all instrumental, but I thought, I'll just stick this on as a bonus track, really. But essentially, what happened was, as I said, you know, I was noodling around in 1976 before going to the studio to record the original version with Simon Phillips on drums and Bill McCormick on bass. And as you can see, it's a lot more up-tempo. And then this weird thing happened where I was driving near here, and I live near Notting Hill and near Ladbroke Grove. And I was in the car with my son, and the phone, I could hear the phone going, so I pulled over, and it was New York ringing, and it was a company called Rockefeller Records, and they said, just want to tell you that Jay-Z and Kanye West have sampled your guitar riff, and it's on a track, which is in fact the first track on the new album coming out next week. I sort of went, no, I think you've got it wrong. It can't be me, because people always get my name mixed up with Ray Manzarek from The Doors, so you must have made a mistake, so... They said, no, we'll play it to you over the phone. We can't send it to you. Obviously, it's top secret. So what we'll do is we'll play it to you over the phone. And so Charlie, my son, was with me at the time. I said, okay, I'll put it on speakerphone. Secretly, I said to him, I'll put it on speakerphone. You record it. And then we'll go back to the studio and we'll mess around with it and send it back to them just for a laugh to sort of fight the system, you know. But anyway, they play it to me. I said, well, it does sound like me, but, you know, it's a lot slower. I said, well, that's great. Thanks a lot. Finished with the phone call. And then I thought, hang on, can they do this? I've got no idea. I mean, do I have any say in this or not? So I rang up the company who owned the copyright, which is EMI Records. And I said, do you know anything about this? And they said, oh, yeah, we've been negotiating this for a couple of weeks. I said, well, shouldn't you have told me something? They said, oh, yeah, but you don't worry about it. You're going to be happy with it. So then I put the phone down there, and then I thought, what about the publishing? Because I wrote it as well. I rang up Universal Publishing and said, do you know anything about this? Oh, yeah, we're negotiating. I said, well, you could have told me. It could have been something that I was not happy with. They said, no, you'll be happy. Anyway, so that's how it happened. And then years later, I discovered that there's this great friend of Kanye's called 88 Keys in New York, and he goes around sampling vinyl, but only specifically, I think, from like 1975 to 1980, just analog stuff, finding it in old bins in record shops, sampling bits and taking bits and pieces. And he was around in New York, and Kanye West and Jay-Z were recording their album, Watch the Throne, in a hotel called the Mercer Hotel in New York. And Kanye rang him and said, hey, man, you got any beats? And he said, no, I haven't got anything. I'm on my way home to see my wife, and she's going to kill me if I'm late, and so forget it. He said, no, I passed by. He said, no, honestly, I haven't got anything, so just forget it. He said, no, please, just pop by. So he did pop by, and I don't know, he played them about 10 things. One of them was the slowdown version of Case Code. And they just said, yeah, we want that one. They wrote a song over the top of it, I guess got the other guys to come and do bits and pieces. And then I think within a week, they'd finished it. It was the last thing to go on the album that they'd been working on for a few years. And it came out and, you know, suddenly it was a big hit. It won a Grammy, you name it. It's been in all sorts of commercials and the Great Gatsby film and all sorts of stuff. It's like incredible. I couldn't quite believe it, because something you do like 35 years previously suddenly appears out of nowhere. It's some weird karma, but it just shows you just keep your head down, keep doing music, you know, keep your karma good, and things happen in this business, you know.
Yeah, I saw there are more than a dozen cover versions of their version of the song on Spotify, at least. It seems pretty satisfying to take something that was sampled and then actually, no, I'm the guy that was sampled. I'm going to actually replay it. And so you said you had to just learn it. You know, it's not even the same key, right?
No, it's not in the same key. So it was actually quite difficult to play, because obviously they'd lowered it to a different key. So it's virtually impossible to play. And I spent ages, and I had all sorts of young people trying to teach me how to play it. But in the end, I worked out a way to play my version of it. And that's the version that's on the recorded version. It's a great riff, I must say, God knows. But the genius thing was 88 Keys. who slowed it down. And I met him in New York. I invited him when I played at Radio City Music Hall with David Gilmour a few years ago. I invited him to come to the gig, and he was such a lovely guy. And I just, when I met him, a great guy with big rasta hair, and he very sweetly, he brought the vinyl for me to sign. The guy is, I just gave him a big hug and said, "What made you slow it down? It's a genius thing. I mean, whoa, all respect, man."
Can you tell me a little about some of the decisions that you made then in coming up with your version? Was this just a very, you know, you said this was going to be kind of a jokey bonus track. Does that mean, you know, the whole thing was put together very quickly, very intuitively, in terms of like where you're going to do these, the layered vocals, and where you're going to put in the extra overdub guitars, and it's a pretty thick arrangement.
That wasn't the jokey version. That was before when they first played it to me, I was going to do it. No, by the time I got to actually learn the riff, I thought, basically, it's a blues number. Sonia, you know, is very good at singing in that sort of jazzy blues style, and she's Portuguese, and she's got, like, it in her, you know, that feeling in her. And I've got a great bass player, great drummer. I thought I'd take the same keyboard stabs from the original, but I wanted to simplify it to a bit and make it more like a band-played version. The chant bit in the middle where we go, way, I just put that in as something totally new. And I thought that might work live. It does seem to work live, where we call and response type idea. So, I mean, to a certain extent, it was done like a single, really, with verse, chorus, verse, solo, middle eight, you know, sort of chant thing, and then choruses out. Not trying to overdub too many things on it, but just to have the certain ingredients that made it work. There's a little arpeggio bit that I put in as an overdub over the riff as well. But basically, because it's got that minor blues progression, it's quite easy to play.
Let's zoom in on one of your guitar. So there's about, what, two or three different guitar solos in here. About 2 minutes in. So I wanted to ask you about that change in tone where you go to the da-da-da-da-da, where it suddenly gets thicker and more dense. Are you actually stepping on a pedal at something, or are you just tightening up on the way you're picking it? What gives it that extra distortion at that point, I guess? It's not quite distortion.
It's actually a plug-in, and I can't remember what it's called, actually, that we use it to try and create virtually impossible guitar playing. So, yeah, I mean, I play the basic solo, then it goes through this thing which then gets sort of re-edited to make it more interesting. And it's something that I've been doing as the technology changed since 1972. And I used to do all this kind of thing with Brian Eno. And then once he left in 73, 74, I started having stuff that would enable me to do it as well. And then now with plugins using, you know, Pro Tools and stuff, you can make quite impossible guitar stuff. You know, I had a track once on my album Primitive Guitars called Impossible Guitars. You know, in those days you cut up bits of tape and stuff and put them back together in. And, you know, it is a continuation of maybe what the Beatles did and everything at Abbey Road with backwards guitars and what they call the inverse echo and all these things that are part of my production tradition. So, you know, I will, when I have guitars now, I will always try and push the boat out and see what else, having recorded your basic stuff with a groove and stuff like that, see if we can take the sound side of it to another place, more interesting and innovative type of sonic place, you know.
I guess it reminds me of Jeff Beck or something, just in that it's, this whole song is very blues rooted, and you've got a, you know, a Hammond sound, but that you're just extending the guitar sort of beyond, again, it's coming from a blues place, but getting, I guess, that just that extra layer of psychedelia by adding those extra bits on it.
Jeff Beck is the best British guitarist ever. everybody here, I think, agrees with that. So, you know, even to be mentioned in the same breath as him is brilliant. You know.
Let me ask you about one more thing that's much, much less flashy. So it's got some of what you're doing guitar is these little reggae sort of offbeat punctuated things. And in some places, you know, it's coming kind of where you'd expect, where it's coming on the two or on the three. But then on some of these verses, like 43 seconds in.
Your love is my spirit tongue. Let me into your
equipment. So you play do-chack right before she sings. But then it kind of, it doesn't just keep doing it on that beat. It's sort of, it's very unpredictable. I was trying to figure out like where it is. It's like the second measure you play on the four, so just the fact that you're doing a rhythm part, a very simple overdub rhythm part, but it's not at all just keeping a groove. It's kind of trying to throw people off, like treating it like auxiliary percussion almost.
In fact, what it is, it's trying to, find the gaps in the vocal rhythm. And all that comes back to reggae, really, in one sense. But also, there's a track called Love is the Drug for Roxy Music. And the rhythm guitar part on that is quite different. And again, it does exactly the same thing. It comes in strange places. And I learned that from being told to do that by Chris Thomas, who was a producer, the Roxy Music producer who worked with George Martin, who worked with everyone from Paul McCartney to Elton John to the Sex Pistols to Pulp, you name it. Roxy Music, obviously, to the Pretenders. This is a great British producer. And so really that is part of my production legacy, really, is to try and make things lock together. And from that point of view, when I'm saying lock together, it's more like the way reggae songs are constructed. They're beautifully crafted in terms of the whole rhythmic structure of the song to get the groove. And that's also in a lot of soul and Tamla Motown.
And in terms of getting the whole band to do that so it locks together, I mean, obviously the rhythm section, you can kind of, that's the basis of the song. But like the keyboard arrangement also sounds very careful on here, and yet it has a little organ solo at the end. So that's not you playing that, right? That's somebody in your band?
Yeah,
that's
someone in the band. But the position of the jabs and everything, that's totally, I did play that, yeah.
Sure.
So, you know, the jabs work with the guitar, you know, so things happen that's, it's not straightforward, because when we play that live, I had to teach the rhythm guitarist guy to play that, because I'll be playing the riff. And I say, right, it's not straightforward. You know, it should, and the keyboard guy, it's got to lock together. And this isn't just mindless stuff. You've got to understand the structure of the groove there.
I was also very surprised that the bass actually ended up matching the guitar riff. You know, that a very fast riff played on guitar doesn't sound so startling, but when the giant sound of the low bass then is following you through this whole thing, it has a much more acrobatic feel. Is that?
You see, Yaron Stubby is the bass player. That he's my go-to bass player, and I got him to play on the David Gilmour album. He plays in a jazz band called Gilad Atzmon. He plays on all Robert Wyatt's albums. He's the best bass player I know, you know, and he's played with jazz greats. I mean, he can just throw that off, which is fantastic. Technically, he's incredible. I mean, he's played with Nigel Kennedy, the violinist, classical stuff. He was in the Berlin Philharmonic. This guy is serious shit. So he suddenly started playing it, and I went, whoa, yeah.
The fact that it happened spontaneously as opposed to, okay, just so you know, you have to learn this exactly as well. Let's.
Oh, God, no. I mean, thing about Yaron, I don't need to tell him anything. He just gets it. He's playing everything I've recorded or produced for other people for the last 10 years. It's just like, you know, you're in safe hands. I always work with musicians who are better than me. It makes you look good.
Well, let's bring our second song into the conversation. Wish You Well from 6 o'clock PM, the album from 2004, which this has Bill McCormick playing bass on it. Is that right?
That's correct. And the reason I chose this is because it's got a story. This song is dedicated to his brother. His brother had died, unfortunately committed suicide, about 3 months before recording the song. We grew up all together at college and school, and it was because of him that I pursued a musical career. He became a famous, quite apart from going, he was about 4 years older than me and Bill. He went to Cambridge University and hung out with Nick Drake, for instance. and then gave up the university and became the assistant editor of the New Musical Express in England, which was like the number one music paper in the 70s. He wrote a very famous book called Revolution in the Head about the Beatles, and his nom de plume was Ian MacDonald. And he tragically died, and it really, you know, affected me, this. And I was on a boat with my kids. We rented a boat and three kids, and I had a guitar with me, and I wanted to do some sort of tribute to him as a sort of send-off. So I wrote this song called Wish You Well. I wanted Bill McCormick, his brother, to play, who had played with me in the band called Quiet Sun and then 801 Live, and also he was in Robert Wyatt's group, Matching Mole. I wanted him to play a sort of tribute bass solo in it. And also on the track, I wanted Chrissie Hynde to sing as well, because Chrissie shared an apartment with him, and Chrissie started writing reviews and interviews for the New Musical Express at the beginning of the 70s before she became Chrissie Hynde and the Pretenders. And Ian got her job at the New Musical Express. So I asked if she'd come and sing along on the track as well. So that's her singing the choruses and a few oohs and ahs. So it's a very personal song, you know, and the lyrics have references to some of the lyrics that he wrote for me on some of my songs that on the album Listen Now. There's a track called Flight 19, you know, that's referenced in there. It was very cathartic, you know. So all the songs that I started doing, there are three albums, Vocero, 6 p.m. and 50 Minutes Later, were a period that I went through, and I wrote all the songs and I got friends to play on all of them. And it was really getting out a lot of issues that were on my mind, those 30 songs in those three solo albums in that period.
Right there before you.
there's a bridge that comes in eventually and a quite a long instrumental passage, but basically these two, I mean, the opening thing sounds like, I can't remember which exact Beatles song, but you know, a 12 string or 12 string sounding descending acoustic.
When you've got like a Guild 12 string guitar, and I knew that I wanted this all to be on acoustic guitars, it was very much one of those kind of songs where you need to hear the voice and the words and have an acoustic feel to it. So, yeah, 6-string acoustic, a 12-string acoustic, bass and drums, really. There was not a few little touches here and there, but pretty much that's it, a very simple sort of song. When I listened to it the other day, that the intro is very long. I can't believe how long it is. I probably would cut it now.
Well, yeah, because you kind of go through the whole... This is just the intro riff, but no, it's the head of the song that eventually becomes the chorus. And then you've got basically an instrumental verse before you even start the vocal. So it really gets a chance to establish itself and establish the nice percussion bed. Is it kind of a bossa nova feel? There's some sort of slightly Latin feel to what the drums or the percussion's doing there.
Yeah, there is a slightly Latin feel. In fact, if I had the album with me, I would look to see you play drums in it because I cannot remember a thing. This is a long time ago.
It says Paul Thompson when I looked online.
Ah, well, it probably is, yes, Paul Thompson, of course, silly me. And right here downstairs where I am now is where we recorded it. You're absolutely right. He played on the whole album. He just played what he played. You know, I said one stick, rim shots and things like that, and just slow little build in the middle 8-bit. Yeah, listening to it now, I was listening to it last night and I thought, wow, did I stick the instrumental version on the album instead of the proper one? Because it took ages for the vocal to come in. Yeah, sorry about that.
So you're singing this, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I thought that was your way of de-emphasizing your vocal or something. I mean, it's a wonderful sounding, very intimate vocal, but it's, you know, very, very buried in the song.
Well, I had something to say. You know, I don't have the best voice in the world, but I was going to do it. You know, it made no sense for anyone else to actually, wouldn't mean anything to anyone else. So I had to do it. You know, obviously when you've got Chrissy Hynde there, you think, oh, why isn't she singing it? But she could have done because she knew him. But no, it was very personal. So I had to step up and do it.
Was having Chrissy do the harmonica thing, which is a very understated, you know, just kind of distinguishes some of the movements in the long instrumental passages by having this thing come in, not even play a melody, really just droning on a few tones. Was that sort of a, you know, after the fact, she's already recording vocals, let's do that too? Or did you have that in your sonic imagination when you were writing this?
I think the same day we did another song where she played harmonica. And I didn't know she could even play harmonica. So I said, all right, do you want to stick some harmonica on this? But yeah, it's minimal. It's just a flavor. And now listening to it now, I thought, oh, that's nice. I don't remember. See, it's great coming back to this stuff years later because you see the good things and maybe there's some things you'd like to change. But I must say, yeah, it achieved what I wanted, which was to sort of help deal with the death of a friend.
I almost forgot to point out the thing that really in the arrangement that thematically works against in some way the very acoustic is this spooky reverbed vocal where you're kind of singing the melody, you know, just right from the beginning of the song, buried in the back, this, that is a ever-present part of the song, and kind of this ghostly effect.
That was done on purpose, yeah, to have a sort of ethereal type shadow to make it, I'm speaking to this person who's somewhere out there, because he didn't believe in God, but he believed in all sorts of other levels of consciousness and stuff. So it was very much appropriate for his speaking out to him if he's out there and just tipping your hat to him. I mean,
is that the kind of thing you would normally do or that you would consider doing as a lead guitar riff? Because you have plenty of songs where you play a sound kind of like that, you know, very buried in effects and that doesn't sound blazing electric particularly. You know, I could very easily see you using your tone palette with lead guitar to do that kind of thing, but this really was just singing into an effect.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and in fact, the effect was there, so I could sing with that effect on. So it wasn't something that was put on afterwards. You're absolutely right. When you see your guitar through all sorts of pedals and things like that, and you play to that sound, it's much more satisfying than actually just playing a straight thing and then treating it later. It's actually another way of doing it, which is enjoyable.
And then the choice to, when you do have Chrissy or... I see also Claire Singers did backing vocals. I'm not sure on this song.
Yeah.
That you're sticking mostly until the very end of the song, just parallel octaves. You're not using it to Beatles it up to make it have a nice little third in the fifth or something like that, that it's really just this stark thing until the very, very end of the song.
Yeah, definitely chromatic sort of stuff. And it didn't seem right to have it sort of, you know, major thirds or minor thirds or just gild the lily too much. And the lily is the symbol of funerals. So, that didn't seem right. You know, I guess it's quite a sort of sad but cathartic type of song, really.
Let's just talk about the middle eight a little bit. I want to play the middle of the middle eight.
And somehow it doesn't seem so surprising, because the truth was right there before your eyes.
Yeah, so you've moved here into kind of Steely Dan territory with the chords here, that it really, any pretense of the Beatles-y opening thing is, we're on full on bossa nova here. Can you say a little about, you know, how you come up with chord progressions, or why you would put that kind of thing exactly there, that movement down there?
I guess when you're trying to do like a middle eight or something like that, or a different section, you want it to be different, to act as a contrast so that you can come back to your original motif or dynamic. There's a dynamic change. And, you know, there's this other side to him. He was very intellectual and pontificated about things. A lot of his things, you know, when you see his whole analysis of the whole of the Beatles catalog, which is always being referenced and quoted, this book, Revolution in the Head, you'll see that he was very astute and could give a lot of insights into things. So I wanted a slightly more strident bit of music to go with this kind of lyric and this kind of talking about another aspect of his personality. And it's funny you should mention Steely Dan, because I had never thought of it, but, you know, I love Steely Dan, and we all love Steely Dan. And we used to listen to music and analyze music when we were 16, 17, 18, all the amazing albums that were coming out in that period, 1968, whether it was The Grateful Dead, Anthem to the Sun, The Doors, Cream, the White Album, you name it, all these Soft Machine first album, The Mothers of Invention. So in this song, there's all sorts of references coming out that mean something to me and to Bill McCormick, who was there when we were listening to all this stuff and assimilating pop music and rock music, which in turn created the people, the musicians that we are.
Yeah, let's talk about Bill's bass solo here. So we got, it's pretty long, and you've got, you know, some keyboard that helps it out, that props it up in some places. I had to look for some reason. So Roxy Music, strangely enough, one of the most distinctive things about the sound of the band to me is the bass, which is strange just given that you went through several different bass players. It's not one person's sound. And I had to look, was Bill one of those guys? Because, you know, he very much has that kind of what I think of a spitty bass sound. In other words, high tone, turn the tone up, not necessarily playing fretless, but definitely sliding up and down a lot and using a lot of vibrato. So it sort of sounds, has that fretless or upright electric sort of sound.
When we were at school and had a school band, Bill was the drummer. One of the drummers. And because we couldn't find a bass player, we told him, you're going to have to learn to play the bass. Well, he then listened to two great bass players in particular who were just in a band at that time. One was a guy called Hugh Hopper from Soft Machine and Jack Bruce. Now, you know, Jack Bruce has played bass guitar like a lead guitar, basically, you know, fantastic technique, classically trained musician, genius. So Bill, if you go back to one of the first albums that I did at the same time as Roxy, it was called the Quiet Sun album. We had a band called Quiet Sun. And in that, you'll hear long bass solos. And it was sort of emulating the bass almost like a lead instrument, as traditionally it has been in jazz. But there's Quiet Sun's song, which actually we then played again in the 801 Live band. Now, if you listen to the 801 Live album, which is a band we had with Brian Eno, me, and Simon Phillips on drums and stuff, and you hear Bill's bass playing, especially on the first track, TNK, which is Tomorrow Never Knows, people talk about it all over the internet still. It's famous, and Bill's style of bass playing was fantastic if you listen to that album. Combination of him and Simon Phillips, who's like the most amazing drummer, still is. So Bill, unfortunately, had a problem with his hand. about 15 years ago. So he could virtually not play at all. So, you know, I came and asked him if he could, as a tribute to his brother, try and get his hands working again. And so what we've got is quite a melodic bass kind of solo. And I just wanted it to be as long as he possibly could to, and I join in towards the end of it so that we had a, like a little bit of a conversation as well, musical conversation together. I wanted him to play tribute to his brother and I wanted to feature him. You know, it's a, not many people have ever heard this story. So this is just what one does on solo albums when it has a chance and there's no A&R person telling you what to do or what not to do. You just do whatever you feel like doing. You don't care whether it's going to sell or not or if anyone's going to hear it. The point is that you are doing it and that's enough. When I break it down and analyze a track like this, which I've never done before, there has a lot of history to all the component parts of it and it has a lot of meaning.
And this one has not made it into any subsequent live sets?
No, this one hasn't. I've only just started playing live again, personally, last year, really, with the 8 gigs in Japan and then in Buenos Aires and then in Barcelona towards the end of the year. But I had decided that I wanted to get out and see more people and to play more live and stop being in the studio because I've done over maybe 80 albums since I started. And who knows, you know, I might gradually integrate some of these other tracks in into the live set, but there's quite a lot of tracks now to choose from, and who knows.
Well, let's get our third song on the table, which, so both the third and then the song that we're going to leave folks with, they're older songs, and you have live versions in the current lineup. So it was interesting to hear. We're going to play the original version of this, the title track from Diamond Head, 1975, which is very much has that, folks are familiar with the Brian Eno solo albums. Well, that's a lot of the same group of musicians, right?
Totally, done at the same time.
And the way that you interpret this now is quite different. That it very much emphasizes where you get to the proper guitar solo part. Let me say that just becomes, after a long piano in the new version, a long piano intro that sounds nothing at all like anything we're about to hear, just gets to this straight, waving your lighter sort of triumphant, soaring guitar solo. It comes through in this old version. It's still majestic, but the whole Eno-esque, well, folks can hear that the main riff in here has this, what is that, a high tremolo guitar, or is that a funny keyboard sound that's playing along with your strummed guitar there? That wah-dop, 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 that part.
You know, in that period, I used to do a lot of stuff in combination, me and Eno, him treating my guitars. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, the lead guitar is totally treated through his VCS3 synthesizer, and that little other bit is treated as well with different kinds of a fast vibrato-type envelope shape, I think. But, yeah, definitely on the whole of that first solo album, which I got a chance to do, you know, Eno is all over it.
Yeah, do you have any other, before we play the song in full, any other introductory words to that period or to this song in particular, since it's such a different palette?
The reason it's called Diamond Head, for a start, is because I lived in Hawaii. I lived when I was 8. I went to school in Honolulu, and at the end of Waikiki Beach, there is Diamond Head, the mountain right there. So when it came to doing a solo album, I wanted to have some personal elements. A, I named the instrumental after and had a, it looks like there's a picture of a train coming around Diamond Head, but of course it's not really it's somewhere else in America. But I needed to somehow tie it, the melody, to some visual image, and sort of that's why it's called Diamond Head. And I think subsequently a heavy metal band called themselves Diamond Head, you know, which is obviously nothing to do with my track.
Oh,
talk just a little more generally how a song like this would be put together. I mean, this doesn't sound like a full band performance, but was that, you know, at least the rhythm tracks, are you getting, you know, and actually rehearsing something a few times and getting it so you can play it through and then treating an overdubbing? What exactly the order of this Eno-esque way of making albums?
We're talking about 1975 here, and we're talking a studio called Basing Street Studios in London, and we're talking, this is just off the Portobello Road, and it's the Island Records recording studio where Free have recorded it all right now. We're in the studio upstairs. The studio downstairs is Bob Marley and the Wailers recording their first album for Island Records downstairs. And there's like a football table where we all meet, you know, and they're all there playing the football and lots of ganja being smoked in their studio. And we're upstairs and we're talking about days before computers or anything like that. And we're playing backing tracks. Yeah. So, okay, these are the chords and there's the bass drums and rhythm guitar first. And we lay down the backing track and then we do overdubs on top of it. And then in the control room, you've got Brian Eno with his VCSV synthesizer, the Revox tape recorders. I've got my Revox tape recorder out there as well. And one of my signals is going to his VCS3 and the straight one's coming in to one. And we're talking about 24 track recording analog.
Yes, I see it is John Wetton on bass and Paul Thompson on drums again. So this is basically an Eddie Jobson doing all the keyboards. So this is pretty much who was in Roxy Music at the time. It had broken up at that point for a couple of years. Is that right? Or no?
No, we hadn't broken up yet.
Okay.
For the first time.
That was a year later or so. Yeah.
There were so many tours going on, Roxy tours. And we finished a tour like in the middle of December. I started recording this album the beginning of January, and I had to get to a Canadian-US Roxy tour by the 1st of February or something. So we had a limited amount of time to do this. It was a crazy period. We were all doing this kind of crazy thing, you know, and I started recording this album. And at one point, we were recording this album from 12 to 6, and then from 6 to 12, we were recording this Quiet Sun album at the same time, very different kind of music. And, you know, and myself and Bill McCormick and Ian McDonald, were involved with both albums. And so we were working like 12 hours a day. And then I got on a plane and went to very ill. I went to Canada, Toronto. And then, you know, in the middle of the night, we all got busted by the Canadian Mounties. So what a great way to start the US-Canadian tour.
Again, a very strange sound palette here that you, just the fact that you've got your combined, this electronic treated guitar, and then even the rhythm guitar, is that an acoustic or just a very strangely EQ'd electric so that you're just hearing?
No, I think it's an acoustic guitar and it could have had phasing on it. And of course, all phasing was done by tape phasing then, not. There were no gadgets and no pedals you could buy or anything like that to do phasing. I don't think even the MXR had come out. I couldn't swear by that, but I don't think in 75.
And then the main riff, we finally get to what is now the centerpiece of the song. So very nice, sustained sound. I kind of associated with a lot of Robert Fripp's work, that sound, again, the same, you know, is it in your head first or is it in your fingers first when you're coming up with a, you know, this is the head of the song. This is not just me soloing here. This is a melody, but it's a very long, drawn out instrumental melody.
Right from 1968, 69, I wanted my guitar to sound like an organ. Really liked and had the sustain of the organ, and the particular organ was the Lowry organ, which Mike Ratledge had in the Soft Machine and used with a distortion pedal, where he could just make the notes go on forever. And that was my ultimate goal from 1968 onwards, with the invention of the fuzz face and all that kind of stuff. And then having these special custom-made pedal boards by a guy called Pete Cornish, who also did David Gilmour stuff, with special fuzz boxes that created unlimited sustain, and also by using these Revox tape recorders, just to make the notes go on for as long as possible so that you could bend them and play them a bit like a cello or a violin or something like that. Then having it treated added an extra dimension onto the whole thing, which hadn't been done before. And I think after that, Eno did No Pussyfooting with Frick. So this came after those initial periods, because that's very much what I was doing with Eno in 1972, having this extended use of notes using these tape recorders, which we had specially modified, both of us live on stage, so that we could achieve this endless guitar, which he then really carried on into U2, this idea of the endless echo.
This is all produced with post-playing processing as opposed to an Ebo. I'm trying to remember the thing that Godley and Cream made.
This is before they invented any of those things. Yeah, that's right. This was a way to achieve that unlimited sustain, you know, using analog method.
Which I would think would be much easier to play fancier stuff, you know, being able to use all your fingers than if you have to hold the Ebo there and have it generate the tone in its wily electric ways, and that you can't play as many. I'm just thinking like Robert Fripp's riff in Bowie's Heroes or something like that, where it's really just, if you're sustaining that much, you can only do so much. You can't fly around as much as you do, even in this song.
Eno applied the same thing to that guitar in Heroes. That's exactly what we were doing, you know, from 1972 onwards with the Rerox tape recorders and stuff. You know, so it got that off to a T, really. But you've got to remember also that during this period, I was also very friendly with Kevin Godley and Lowell Cream, and they had invented the Gizmo, which was an attachment that went onto the guitar to try and create continuous sustain by these little wheels above each string, which they, I think, had got the idea from Leonardo da Vinci's drawings of something. But that's another story. They're geniuses, those two guys, Kevin and Lowell.
Really only a few melodic elements in here. We've got the wah-da-wah, wah-da-wah part, and you've got your main guitar riff. You carry this through. I mean, this is a good 4.5 minute, you know, very leisurely in the way it progresses. I know a lot of sort of what keeps it interesting, what keeps the arrangement is the keyboards, you know, come in and are doubling you or, you know, playing around.
You mean there was like the middle 8-bit where Eddie Jobson doubled, multi-tracked his violin and we took it down an octave to create a sort of a string section with a little riff halfway through. I mean, I've forgotten how great Eddie Jobson was on this track. His musicality, really, underneath my simple line, you've got quite technical playing, keyboard playing there. And then you've got the string part, which we multi-tracked to create like an orchestral thing. It's not a keyboard. They hadn't invented string keyboards, apart from the Mellotron, of course. Yeah, so that was real strings. Him, just one man.
The middle 8 section, actually, let me play a little bit before we can talk about getting out of that. You talked about the middle 8 of the last song. Say a little bit about how you decide how long it's going to go, how different it's going to be. I recall an interview with Pete Townsend saying, oh yeah, you got to change it up a little bit for the middle 8, but not too far. Don't make it, you know, go into off into prog land. And this kind of obeys that. It's still staying, other than bringing in Jobson's string strumming there. Like, well, we've just made it a little darker, but we're basically in the same sonic palette. And then we're just give us a place to open it back up into the main riff again when we're done with it.
All the so-called chorus and the verse bit is in a major key and everything. And then for the middle 8, you go into a B minor with a little bit, with just two other chords. And so just go literally like it is only 8 bars probably, and then comes out back into a verse. So it's a very classic song structure, if you like, but done for an instrumental. And obviously to make it different, you've got the great Eddie Jobson doing his string part as if there's an orchestra coming in. He does some flourishes on the keyboard and stuff like that. So I try to still not wig out too much. Therein lies the difference between this recorded version and then when I play it now on stage, that middle bit, which is the version, we did a version with the 801 Live where it became super heavy and twice the length and turned into something completely wig out different. But here it's very controlled, trying to do a short song, if you like.
Well, it's controlled, but I think you do it four times, right? As you say, each time the verse goes into minor, so it can emerge into major, but it actually does that four times. So like the whole middle eight ends up being quite, you know, a middle 32, so to speak.
Maybe it is 32. It's definitely 16. It needed it. I was young then. I was only 24 when I did this.
When that finally is done, that's the place where you have that transition that you've already been guitar soloing, and I thought you were already using the ultra sustain sound, but now this new sound comes in at 248 here. So it's a whole, no, this is the actual more distorted, super sustained guitar that makes it even more majestic. You thought you were already there, but no, here's a whole different tone to take the place of that and take it into a new space, you know, for the rest of the song, which, you know, again, for a short song, well, I guess this only goes for 30 seconds and then we go back to your original, the wah-da-wah, the da-da-da-da part.
This was meant to be a sort of relief. And the drums virtually disappear. It's meant to float. Mm-hmm. It's the floating section before coming back to the final little outro riff, if you like. So it was meant to have a series of melodic bits. It's definitely meant to be building on melody and mood and sound, not this is me, you know, showing off playing guitar.
It's not Cream's Wheels of Fire. It doesn't just go...
No, it's not. I probably would like to have been able to do that, but I thought best not to.
We've got a couple back and forth between the two sections for the remaining minute and a half of the song with some kind of more strings coming in. Yeah, string pads I had put in somewhere around the 3 minute mark. And it's almost, you know, it's a very gradual thing that it sort of becomes more orchestral and full. So yeah, really, really wonderfully coherent, put together thing. Then you completely reinterpreted for this new version, just, you know, playing on this main head, which is what you came in on at the end section, but was already there right at the beginning. You know, is it just a matter of you get these great players in your band and you know, they're familiar with the old song, or you just start playing it and see what happens with the arrangement? Or is it a little more controlled than that in terms of modernizing this, bring it to a live?
When we came to do it with the 801 band, which had incredible musicians, you know, who could play virtually anything in funny time signatures, you name it. I mean, Simon Phillips, you know, went on to play Stanley Clarke with Jeff Beck, with Mick Jagger, you name it. He was only 18 when he was in 801 Live. And after that concert and that album, he just exploded, you know. And when it came to playing this live, it didn't seem enough. It seemed a bit short and a bit wimpy. So they just gave it some complete bollocks and said, right, okay, well, we're just going to go for it and change the arrangement at the very end and make it really kick. And when I came back to playing stuff last year, I said, let's do the 801 version because that gives it extra whittling for guitaring.
Well, that seems like a good transition into the last thing we're just going to introduce and we're going to be done here. Magdalena, this actually is the version from Live in Japan, released last year, but it's an older song. Can you say a little about where this originally came from and the transition to the new version?
It's called Magdalena. That was my mother's name. She was born in Barranquilla, Colombia, next to the Rio Magdalena, the river there. She was the person who started teaching me guitar in Havana, Cuba in 1957. So I wanted to do a tribute to her. The first little bit is based on what she taught me how to play, but obviously on a Spanish guitar, on a Cuban guitar, which I still have here right near me. And then it goes into an up-tempo bit at the end. I played it at some prog rock orchestra thing in Sweden years before I recorded this, and people seemed to like it, and it was short and to the point. And I thought, okay, well, this is good, and it has a resonance for me. So I've continued playing it live, and it's got a little bit of a Latin feel too. It ticks a lot of boxes, and it has, you know, resonance for me. And I tell people about the story about learning from my mother and stuff like that.
All right. And the original version is on Sound of Blue. That's right. But you say it was written several years before that.
There was a version, but not released live. It was on a thing I did in Sweden with a prog rock orchestra.
Can you tell a little about, like, is this live band going to do a new studio album? What's the next thing? I know you've been doing a lot of ethnic, Latin-flavored festivals, you know, quite a lot of different projects in different directions here and there.
We did a whole album called Coroncho, which is me and a Colombian guy downstairs and basically using the same people in this band. And we went and played in Barcelona, a little thing just for Christmas. And actually, in the year before, we played in Cartagena in Colombia to launch the album. But we are at the moment looking at maybe doing some festivals in the summer here in Spain. And basically, yeah, we want to get out and play. So everyone's primed and ready. So we're looking for gigs. So maybe someone might be interested over there in the US of A.
Well, and a wonderful mix of things that you've got, you know, Roxy Music stuff with the female live singing. You've got things from a lot of these other little projects, the things in Spanish, a very peculiar Jackson 5 cover. Is that right? I Want You Back.
With a double bass guitar, just her and a double bass. She's great. Yeah. And then we have a Caetano Veloso song that she sings. I mean, there's something for everybody, basically. We enjoy ourselves.
So is it really just taking advantage of who's in the band in terms of suggesting songs and, you know, really making it it sounds very much like a group project, but very with a lot of guitar. Still has that, you know, I can play as much as long guitar as I want. That it's a guitar-driven band, but very much an ensemble, not your solo stuff.
No, we tried to make it entertaining as a live project. You know, you do what you have to do to try and make it work.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Here's Magdalena. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
Thanks so much to Phil. Get to check another one of my musical heroes off my list. I recall Steve Petrenko, who's been on this podcast, was my college roommate and bandmate, saying that Roxy Music was the granddaddy of all the other music I liked, of XTC and the other stuff like that. This somewhat artsy, very sound conscious, but still very catchy, theatrical rock and roll. And of course, as you've heard, Phil has done many things that really don't sound anything like Roxy Music. I will post links to some other things of his you might want to hear from the blog post associated with this episode at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. You can go find out directly about Phil at manzanera.com. And again, please, please, please support the podcast at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. And I'll tell you, I have also launched a Patreon page for my own songwriting, if you want more of that to exist. That is patreon.com/MarkLint. I have many recordings out there just waiting for the funds for them to be completed. All right, looking forward, the next Nakedly Examined Music episode will be my interview with Sean Phillips. If that name does not ring a bell, look him up. He was a very important figure, especially in the early 70s. Fascinating story. Tune in again to hear that. I have 5 other episodes recorded beyond that. The latest that I just recorded this week with Byron Isaacs, whose bass playing you've definitely heard on something, but his main band was a New York City gospel-based band called Ola Bell. He's touring right now with the Lumineers, and he's just now releasing his first solo album, which I gotta tell you is great. All right, I hope your summer's going well. Hope your creative juices are flowing. So keep on musicking. I'm gonna leave you now with a little more of K-Scope. This is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off.